Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm here with Anthony McCarthy, who joins me for this hour, as we talk with our mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. And Mayor, welcome. Good to see you once again in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure.
Very eager to come. I heard Baltimore's most eligible bachelor was officially off. Congratulations to you.
And Anthony married us.
Did you?
I performed the ceremony. It was very emotional.
I just want you to know that I actually don't feel slighted. as mayor, I can marry people. You didn't think of me at all.
Wow.
Well, you know, I
and just for the record, in October it will be 10 years. So I do have a track record.
10 years?
Yeah, for 10 years.
You'll be married for 10 years.
Yes.
I know. I met your husband years back at a function.
So I have a track record to run on.
That's right.
Well, this is...
It was a very small ceremony, 7 people.
Yep. Very quick, very nice, very sweet.
I am available.
All right, well, next
for weddings
time,
we'll and bar mitzvahs.
No, they've not at least one for me. Maybe my daughter gets married or something like that, then I'll call you.
There you go.
But we did discover that I think that the most important question today is I think that our dogs are siblings.
They look like twins.
So I'll have to call Betty Jean Murphy and get to the bottom of this.
Yes.
So on to matters of the city. We had a situation, you know, where all the pools were closed and you went out and talked to philanthropies and talked to people of means and people who support the city to open the pools again. And I was reading an article in New York Times, I think it was today's Times or maybe yesterday's Times, about what other cities are going through. I mean, in Hawaii, they closed every school on Friday. So they had the shortest school day of the year because they were trying to save money. Places like Clayton County, Georgia, shut down its entire bus system, sold all of its some of its buses, leaving almost 9,000 people stranded. This is happening all of Colorado Springs has sold its helicopters and shut down huge portions of the city government. And cities around America are feeling a pinch. So while it's just amazing and commendable and a powerful move that you made to ensure that especially inner city kids have a place to go before schools start to swim, is this the situation the cities are going to be in from now on, where we have to turn to the super wealthy to say, keep our pools open, to cut back on services? I mean, where are American cities? Where is Baltimore going in the future? I mean, we seem to be facing a very dark period. So what does a mayor do to respond to that, you or any other mayor?
I think there are two ways to look at it. I think you're saying that it's a dark period, but I think when we are using all of our community assets together, not depending on one, you know, whether it's the government or the community or the philanthropic community, not depending on one of those entities to carry the whole burden, I think we're getting to our best selves. And, you know, one of the guiding principles of the transition team that I put together, I asked them to look for creative ways that we can increase the number of public-private partnerships, because I believe that is the wave of the future, and I don't consider it a dark time. I think that is the way that we all feel invested. Those private donors and organizations that came forward are invested in our city. They want our young people to reach their fullest potential. I don't see that as a dark time. I see that as encouraging. I see that as them, as the community coming together for the good of the entire city.
But Anthony, do you want to say something?
Mayor Rawlings-Blake, some of the members of the council and some of the state legislators were encouraging you to keep the pools open, but they suggested that you tap into the city's rainy day fund. Very quickly, they were saying, get those dollars, get those pools open. You took great, you got very, very, very specific with some of the council members that you thought that was kind of economically irresponsible for the city to tap into its rainy day fund.
Economically irresponsible, legislatively irresponsible. You know, we have a budget process for a reason. It is a very open and transparent process. I sat down with every member of the council. I asked them about their priorities. Everything was on the table. I was lauded by the council members for being clear for every dollar that I was asking for. You know, we started with the $70 million in cuts, and then for the new revenue, I laid out where every single dollar was going. And I even said, listen, these are what I consider my priorities. What are yours? So we can see if we can work together and have a shared list of priorities. Keeping the pools open until Labor Day was never discussed. It was clear.
Was it just assumed it was going to happen?
Absolutely not. It was very clear. I started off by saying I was lauded for being clear about where every single cent was going. Every single cent in new revenue was going. It was going to make sure that we kept every single recreation center. There were 29 that were due to be closed. Every single one open until the beginning of school while we took a comprehensive look at our recreation centers and made plans for the future. The comprehensive plan also included an abbreviated pool season. Everyone understood that. So to have this sort of, you know, 11th hour, last ditch, go to the rainy day fund is irresponsible on so many different levels. I don't think you should pander to the community to suggest that it is a priority when you know, just like everyone else knows, you knew 6 weeks ago that this day was coming. If it was a priority, put it on the table. Let's try to find ways to, if the, you know, maybe the city, we could have tried to come up with funds. You know, I had the, you know, 4 cents, the bottle tax on the table. If it was a priority, let's figure out, let's use that. Maybe we could have gone to 3 cents if enough of the council members thought that it was important. But no, you know, we didn't discuss that. So at the last minute to talk about using rainy day funds when we could have actually been planning for that is irresponsible on, you know, a multitude of levels. And to suggest it by coming at the last minute and asking for rainy day funds as a way to be responsive to communities, I think it suggests a level of unsophistication of the public to think that they would believe that coming at the day before the pools close, demanding rainy day funds is responsible. It's pandering.
410-319-8888. I encourage you all to join us here. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is in the studio with Anthony McCarthy and I. We're here having a conversation with her and with you at 410-319-8888. And I do want to ask you to call in as quickly as you can, because I think the mayor will only be here for at least a half an hour. I think she has another engagement, and so we want to make sure that you are on the phones early to have a conversation with her at 410-319-8888. Just to follow up where we left off for a moment, I think the idea of public-private partnerships is important, and it's a very clear way that people can kind of think about the future of the city. However, private industry is not hiring. The economy is down. The only jobs that were developed, the majority of jobs developed were developed because of the Census Bureau, not because of private industry. Those jobs are gone. People are desperate for work. So, and private-public partnerships are not going to keep rec centers open. They're not going to pay for the education of our children. They're not going to build the infrastructure of cities. Something has to happen in America in our urban centers if we're going to survive as a nation and as a city. I think, and I don't mean to paint a dark picture, because they don't like dark pictures, obviously, but I think that it's realistic to say that America is facing a crisis. We have to figure out what we're going to do about that and how we're going to pay for the things that you grew up with, and you're younger than I am, that I grew up with in a city. So the question is, how do you, as a political leader, how do political leaders respond to that in America now? What do we say to the voters next year if you run again?
So you need a short-term strategy and a long-term strategy. In the short term, we're making sure that we get the best bang for our buck. Every single dollar that we spend, that we're being careful about the money that we spend, that we're looking for opportunities to cut waste. We did that in an extensive process during the whole budget process. And so that's the one thing that we're being responsible about spending. And then the long-term plan is, how do we build our tax base and how do we build the businesses and the industries that are working in Baltimore? That's why I've been pushing so hard for things, particularly around the tourism industry. That's our largest single industry in the city. And that's why I've been pushing really hard. You know, the Grand Prix, it's a fun race, but it's, to me, about jobs and economic development. You know, we have the historic tourism that hopefully will get generated from the bicentennial of the War of 1812. You know, it's not a history lesson. That's money in the bank. That is historical tourism that will, you know, bring people into our city, fill up our restaurants, fill up, you know, our streets, and make them alive and help bolster our economy. So, you know, that's why I'm focusing on those in the long term, doing things that will create or give incentives for people to live in Baltimore and people to visit Baltimore to keep our city strong for the long term.
Then, Anthony, go ahead and open the phone. We've got a lot of people calling in, so we'll get
Madam Mayor, I want to ask you talked about the economics of the city, short term and long term. You just went through a very tough budget cycle, mm-hmm. and you made some tough decisions. The council was engaging with you on some tough decisions. There are still questions about pensions for our police and our fire. You and the council were subject to a billboard downtown Baltimore. Some police and fire taking some shots at you and the city council about your leadership.
We should be clear. It was the police and fire leadership.
Union, you're right.
Union leadership. I can't tell you how many messages I got from active duty members that said that they had absolutely no part in that and that they were ashamed. You know, that no one reveled in having to make those tough decisions. But part of making sure that the city is in or on sound fiscal footing for the long term is not about sugarcoating. It's not about, you know, let's put a Band-Aid on it so it can be somebody else's problem 6 years from now. It's about being honest about the situation that we're in and doing something. And even though that many of the officers weren't satisfied with the outcome, they understood and respected the process.
I was going to ask you, are you concerned at all? You don't have an election until next year. Were you concerned about any political consequences of having to make those choices?
You know, I probably should be, but that's not how I was taught. You know, it's interesting when I'm faced with tough decisions like that, and you have to, and you have the choice. I have the choice of doing what is politically expedient or what is right for the city. I just remember that when my dad passed, and one of the things that Cass Taylor said about my father was that he didn't poll. You know, he didn't care about polls. That he took his poll every morning when he looked at himself in the mirror.
Right.
And if he could look at himself, you know, and be comfortable that he was doing the right thing, that's what mattered. And for me, this was one of those times. There were 100 different things I could have done to make the union leadership happy, but it wouldn't have been the best thing to do for the city. And I was very honest with the union leadership. I told them, I said, under no circumstance will I tell you not to do your best to represent the interests of your membership. So don't tell me not to represent the interests of my city. I have to do the best job that I can, and you have to do the best job that you can. And in a perfect world, we would meet on that same line. But if we can't, so be it. Let's agree to disagree. But, you know, it wasn't for lack of trying. It wasn't for lack of, you know, putting all of the information out there. But again, at the end of the day, in my heart, I knew, you know, you have to do what's best for the city moving forward. If that makes some people unhappy, you know, that's how it is. But you can't, you know, we can't hold on to a pension system that was only a pension system on paper. We didn't have the money to back it up long term. And that's a lie. You know, you can't do that.
We have a lot of people calling in. We get to all these calls coming in here. One last question before we hit the phones. Michael and Ashburton, Tisha in Baltimore, Doris, we're going to come to talk both these next three calls coming up. But what you just talked about, I understand that as a mayor, you have to deal with things that face you at this moment. You have to address the issues that you are confronted with. But it seems to me that when something is really amiss, and I hate to keep going back to this, but something's amiss when we have retirees who are facing cuts in their pension, who are facing losing their medical care, who have been firemen, policemen, taught our children, cleaned our streets, built our infrastructure, worked in our rivers, done whatever they've done, and now they're about to lose that. I mean, that, to me, it seems in some ways, well, you may have to do what you have to do immediately to deal with that. We need some political leadership to stand up to that and saying it's not acceptable that our fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers are going to lose what they have.
That's the so I guess the first point is they're not losing everything that they have. There, some members are getting a reduced benefit to make sure that we're able to pay for everyone's retirement. We're not taking away anyone's retirement. And the city did what many private industries have done over the last, you know, 10, 15 years, which is be reasonable about what pension benefits, retirement benefits the city can afford on an ongoing basis. This pension reform the public pension reform, it lagged all the other industries because of the political component to the reform effort. But this is not inconsistent with what many and almost all industries have had to do, taking a hard look at proposed pension benefits over the long term and making sure that there was actually money to back those up.
Let me open the phones, I promise, before just hogging this mic with Anthony. 410-319-8888 as we talk with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. Michael and Ashburton, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Good afternoon. Madam Mayor, my question is simply this. As a taxpayer and a citizen of Baltimore City, why is my water bill much more higher than Baltimore County, parts of Anne Arundel County, and parts of Howard County, who get their water from the city, but yet they pay much less than what I pay?
So I think, and I certainly am not vying for your production manager's job or production director's job, but I think, you know, if I had the job of picking who you should have on next, having on our director of public works would be a good person to have to talk about that, because it's a myth that they're charging different rates. By law, the utility must charge the same amount to Baltimore City residents that all the other jurisdictions pay. The difference is we bill for water services in a different way. Part of their in the other jurisdictions, they bill directly for a portion of the water services, and then part of the water services are paid as a proportion of property taxes or other fees. So they don't see those on their actual water bill. But we have to, every user has to pay the exact same amount. How they get to that number is up to the jurisdiction. As long as, you know, we're getting our money, we're not going to tell you you can't charge for it three different ways. But I would love the opportunity for our director of public works to come in, because that is a myth about the water system, and because of the infrastructure work that we are tasked to do because of federal mandates. I think it would be a good time to have Director Fox come in and talk about what we're doing with DPW.
Let's have the director join us. 410-319-8888. Tisha, in Baltimore, you're on the air. Tisha, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to address one of the topics that was brought up earlier regarding using tourism to build or help to rebuild the economy here in Baltimore. One of the things that really has puzzled me, I'm presently a graduate student at the School of Social Work, University of Maryland, downtown, and the Charm City Circulator, it circulates in, you know, a particular area around the university, around South Point, Federal Hill, you know, around the hotel areas where a lot of affluent people merge, where a lot of tourists merge. And though I've never been on the circulator, I usually walk or catch the subway or I pay for the bus, which is what most residents do, I've heard that the circulator is free. Now, being a tourist in other parts of the country, people usually calculate having to pay for transportation when they go and visit or they go on tour.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that the circulator has not been used in that way? It seems like a very nonsensical way to just gain a bit more money instead of raising the public transportation rates for those who are already in the city who have to use it every day. Why not take advantage of the opportunity? We have tourists who come to visit Baltimore. They've got to get around. Not charge them anything exponential, but charge them the same thing that we get charged. I don't understand that.
So, if I may?
Please, please.
So the Charm City Circulator is one of those things that I see and many see as an economic development tool. It connects neighborhoods. It connects neighborhoods to each other. It connects tourists to neighbors, neighborhoods. It is a free service supported by parking revenue that also makes it easier and less expensive for people along the route to park. If you work downtown and live along that route, you can pay a cheaper parking rate out in the outskirts and use a circulator to get into downtown to work. You can save money on transportation if you're going out of town and you need to get to Penn Station. It is a way to enhance mobility, as well it enhances economic development and economic activity along the route. And I know it's something that is, you know, while it's controversial because it's free, it's working. In the a few months that it's been up and running, we've had over 500,000 riders so far. So it is filling a need that exists in the city.
I want to ask you. 500,000 riders.
500,000 riders.
Wow. I want to ask you a different, move to a different subject. I know we have a lot of callers, but I want to ask you very quickly, since we're talking about the circulator, recently I attended the Charles Village Safety Summit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was packed, well over 300 people packed into the basement of a church in Charles Village. And a lot, over and over again, some people talked about the murder of Stephen Pitcairn. And they mentioned that if the mayor would allow the circulator to come past Penn Station, maybe Stephen Pitcairn would have had another option instead of walking the streets that late up in Charles Village. Is there any plan to expand the route of the circulator?
There's definitely plans to expand the route of the circulator north as well as other routes.
So what you were just talking about, Anthony, I we had a show yesterday about our youth and violence in this community and what happened over the weekend with 13 people being shot and in the streets of Baltimore. And there's this perception that we have a very violent and dangerous city. Even though the shooting rates have seemingly gone down, as have the murder rate is a little, so slightly less than it was last year, it's still too high, as we would all agree, I think. So what about this perception of our city and the fact that people are afraid? People seem to be terrified to live in our own communities. And I guess it also comes back to the question, the issue of money, funds, and how we address issues of poverty and kids in our street with nowhere to go and what happens in the inner cities, especially the inner cities and the poorest neighborhoods. And I think it takes more than just Mr. Bernstein and Ms. Jessamy arguing over whether we're locking up enough people. There's deeper issues here. And how do you, again, you can, if you're running again, you're going to have to face this. You have
if,
to face
if
the voters.
If I'm running, are you trying to start stuff again?
If I'm running. I would never do that.
I heard about you guys
what
theorizing
I
about me becoming a judge.
I'd never theorize you're going to judge. So people did theorize about you becoming a judge on this show, but I don't theorize about things I do not know.
I'm teasing.
But they did theorize
you
about that.
Yeah.
About those Judge Rawlings Blake was about to come around the corner. But
yeah.
No, I have a feeling you're going to run again, but
yeah.
But when you do run, mm-hmm. These are issues we face.
Yeah, definitely.
So
it's. I think if someone were to ask me what's one of the most frustrating things about my job as mayor, is the disconnect between the data and the perception of crime, because while there. I'm one of those people that don't believe that there's an acceptable amount of death.
Right.
Don't believe
as well
that there's an acceptable amount of violence. But at the same time, I think it's a disservice to the men and women that wear blue and protect our streets not to acknowledge the progress that we've made. And while there have been media reports about the increase in violence, particularly on the weekend, the data doesn't support it being an increase in violence. If you look year to year comparisons, I think if you look at the Friday, Saturday, Sunday shootings, we've had the lowest in 6 years. Our homicide rate is down. Our shooting rate is down. You should actually take a look at it sometime and remember what it was like. You know, back when I was in high school in the 80s. And in college in the 90s, the number of shootings was dramatically higher than it is now. And one would think that if you were to be able to bring the number down to as low as we were at that time, nobody thought we could get under 300. You know, nobody thought that it was possible to have this significant decrease in crime. But now we're here, and people forget where we've come from. So I don't think that there's an acceptable number, but what I find frustrating is how do you acknowledge the progress we've made and also address still the feelings that some communities have that they are unsafe in their own home. And that's what I'm working on, and that's why I'm so vigilant about making sure that I go out on citizens on patrol walks and that I'm partnering with communities that they understand that they have a true partner in public safety in the mayor's office as well as in the commissioner's office.
I mean, if you put it on the table, the reality is that people, when a young white student from Hopkins is murdered, Mr. Mm-hmm. Pitcairn, and when Mr. Holmes is murdered, who's a 70-year-old church caretaker, that put things on the front burner because those people became human beings. The problem is that most people who are shot and murdered in our streets are not seen as human beings.
You don't have to tell me. I do the ride-alongs with the police officer. I pulled up on a scene as they were putting a man who was dead. They didn't pronounce him, but everyone knew that he was dead as they put him in the ambulance. And people sat out on the curb and no one saw anything.
Well, people were terrified to see anything, though. They are frightened to see things. Now, Mayor, look, if you come out of your home, you're not going to be frightened to walk down the street and get in your car and be taken to City Hall. But if you're living somewhere on Gilmore Street and a murder is taking place in the corner and you know the thugs around the corner, the ones who did it, and they know who you are, you're not about to stand up and go, I saw who did it. I'm going to tell you right here who did it. I mean, people are terrified.
I understand that people are terrified, but I also understand that while I feel that there's not an acceptable amount of violence, as long as we stand silent, we are standing in agreement that there is an acceptable amount of death on our street.
How do we protect those people who are going to stand up?
Protect them. They have to be able to come forward. Well, you have to have somebody to protect. They're not coming forward. The police, we're battling with a clearance rate because no one wants to say anything. We put things in place so you can give anonymous information. You have to get people to sign up to want to do those things. There has to be a cry from, you know, I watched a guy on the television say it just last night, there's outcry when it's a student from Hopkins, but there's blood on our streets on a regular basis and there's no outcry. The outcry can't come from me. It can't come from you. It has to come from the people in those neighborhoods that want more, that value life more, that want more for themselves and for their children. You know, we have to find a way to value each and every life in this city. And it's more than about fear. It's about having a value on that life that is lost, enough that you overcome the fear, that you overcome, you find a way to get that information to the police department. You don't even have to, I mean, you put it on a postcard. You know, you don't have to raise your hand and say, you know, me at 222 Main Street, I saw the crime and I'm willing to testify. But get the information in. We have to be partners. You can't turn a blind eye and then blame everyone else when there's no outcry.
The head of the police union, Madam Mayor, said that it's time for the commissioner and for you to come up with a new policing strategy. He evidently feels like we're going in we're going in the wrong direction. Is it time to assess the strategy that's been used over the last 2 years, the last 4 years, and with this new commissioner?
I think it's, you know, I think just like every organization needs to constantly reassess, every plan needs to be constantly reassessed. And if violence and shootings and homicides are an indication of success, then I think that we're on the right track. I don't think I can task the commissioner with changing the perception of crime. That's something that, you know, I feel I work on. I feel like the community, we have to work on together. But the numbers are trending in the right direction.
Let me get back to the phone. She's going to take a very quick break. Come right back to the mayor before she has to leave us. The number here is 410-319-8888. And we'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm here with my friend Anthony McCarthy. We're here with our mayor, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. 410-319-8888. I promise I'll go right to the phones, and I will. Let's see who's been holding on for the long, long time. And let us go to Charlie in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Charlie. Welcome.
I'm Mayor Rawlings Blake. How are you?
Great, thank you.
I'm calling to ask about the condition of our schools and what the city can do about it. Our schools are unsafe, dilapidated. They lack the educational facilities that our kids need. And it's discouraging to our kids. And where we've renovated our schools, the kids seem to respond much better, like at Digital Harbor and some other places. So we have a well-documented master plan that shows we need about $2.8 billion worth of capital investment in our schools. And the city's been putting up $20 million a year. At that rate, we'll just never get there. The state gives us 25, 30, right. So we really appreciate your pledge not to cut the operating budget of schools, but we can't just let the school buildings continue to fall down. And in addition to everything else, the condition of the school buildings takes money out of the operating budget because the buildings aren't energy efficient, et cetera, et cetera. We need help from the state, but for the state to help us more, we need for the city somehow to ramp up its capital investment. And other cities and states have done it. So how do you feel about this? What could you commit to?
I agree with you that we need more money for capital improvements in our school. We need more. We need new schools. We haven't had new school construction in too long to remember.
That's true.
But at the pace that we're going, we can afford maintenance and maintenance only. We have to get creative about how to leverage the funds that we have on an ongoing basis to do more for our schools. And I started having conversations with Dr. Alonzo about those that possibility. And I pledge to work with him to come up with a way that we can leverage the resources that we have to be able to do more. So we can find a way to create new schools, that we can find a way to make sure that our schools, that all of them, not just some of them, have air conditioning, that we can make sure that we're using energy efficiently. And it's about creative financing. And I think we have enough smart people in the city. We can figure out how to do it. And I've already committed to him to work on that.
Ken, well, let's go back to the phones. Hmm? Quesha, I was going to go ask a question, but our listener's been waiting here. Quesha in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Ms. Rawlings-Blake, I wanted to make a comment regarding the pension. You had made the statement about the idea that, you know, the folks were probably going to have to take a cut in their pensions. And I want to know exactly what are all political folks that are handling the finances, that are handling the budget, exactly what are they doing? Because it seems to me you've got had commissioners, former police commissioners removed, a mayor that had to step down because of financial indiscretions and things of that nature. And as a Baltimore City resident and a tax-paying citizen, I find it a big slap in the face. You know, we spend a lot of money building prisons to hold guys and women that commit street crimes, but what about our political officials that are committing those types of crimes at their level? I think the people, we're lied to, you know, feel used. You have somebody work 20 or 30 years for a particular agency just to find out that they cannot reap the benefits that they sowed along the way. And I think that is very unfair and a big slap in the face. I'm not blaming you because, of course, you came in at a time when there was a huge mess going on. But I want to know, I mean, what do these people hear? And as a taxpaying citizen, what do we have to look forward to?
So one of the things that I looked at when we were talking about pension reform is, you know, how to make an unfair situation, you know, make the best out of an unfair situation. And as I talked with council members, as I talked with union officials, as I talked with the finance department, we took a look at what that cutoff would be, and decided that we would use 15 years. So if you've been on the force for 15 years, there would be no change in your pension status. 15 years or less, that you would need to work an additional 5 years in order to reap those benefits. The reason why I said to make an unfair, make the best out of an unfair situation is because no one wants to be in the position that we are, to be able to say to people who signed up for one thing that now you have something different. But the financial realities are what they are. We had to do something to create stability and the long-term health of the pension system. So I understand the frustration of the caller. I certainly understand the frustration of those men and women in blue that risk their lives every single day they go to work, the frustration they have that their pensions have pension promise has been changed, you know, that in midstream for some of them. But as I said, you know, it is not a situation that any of us created, but it is one that I felt obliged to fix.
Ken, on the way back to the phones here, Ken, Commissioner Bielefeld remain commissioner if State's Attorney Jessamy wins the election.
They're both professionals.
They are, but reality, I mean, this is a pretty huge breach in terms of some people's eyes, nothing illegal, but a breach in some ways. And we've always had this huge divide between her office and the police department. Almost every administration, every commissioner I've interviewed, there's been an issue between the commissioner and the state's attorney. And
they're professionals, and I'd task my commissioner to act as such. You know, and I know that that State's Attorney Jessamy is a professional. Listen, I didn't take it personally.
They're both are. No question about that.
I didn't take it personally when I was running for council president, and she was on the radio, this radio station included, on behalf of my opponent. Didn't take it personal, didn't care. She has a right to her opinion. I work with her like I've always worked with her and continue. I speak around the city saying that she's my partner in crime reduction, that she is my partner in the criminal justice system as we try to move the city forward. I don't, you know, that was yesterday. You know, I don't take that moving forward. And I don't think that Commissioner Bielefeld and she should, you know, we shouldn't have these conversations after Election Day. After Election Day, it's over. We move forward. You know, each of us are tasked with our particular part of the puzzle to keep our city safe. But, and we have to do that.
But, Madam Mayor, she actually called into question his integrity and his ability to lead this police department. So how do you seem very confident that they will be able to just put this behind them after the primary and move
professionals
forward? Okay.
410-319-8888 is our number, and we're here with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, and who's been here the longest. Let me look here, and sorry, there's so many people calling in here. Let us go to Leo. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi, Leo.
Good evening, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. How are you?
Great, thank you.
Okay, and Mark and Anthony,
Hi, Leo.
I'm concerned. I have some perceptions of my own based on what I've heard you say and others. And I don't believe that the slot machine initiative is enough to rescue the desperate job situation that we're facing in our city. I'm a proponent of an aggressive homesteading and housing development program that's going to rid us of some of these 17,000 abandoned houses that we have in Baltimore City. Why can't we create more job and job training programs around abandoned housing? Why can't we aggressively provide the technical assistance necessary to promote home-based business development? There are a lot of people who want to work for themselves, but we don't seem to have the creative bent necessary to promote self-employment in ways that are meaningful. We don't necessarily have to have a large factory move into these open spaces. We just need to have some creative leadership. And last but far from least, has one of the best programs of reclaiming drug addiction, 24 hours on demand. And yet it appeared to me that this city for a long time has been in opposition to that kind of private initiative, which we should have been underscoring. We've got 70,000 addicts, and we don't have a 24-hour treatment and placement kind of assistance for those addicts.
Okay, yeah, it's just an interest of time. I do apologize, but I know the mayor has to run to an event fairly quickly, and I want her to have a chance to respond.
So hopefully I haven't worn out my welcome, and you'll invite me back.
I hope you will come.
In
course.
A little bit.
This is your forum.
So I can talk about the restructuring that we're doing at the housing department and how that will help us streamline the disposition process and get more of the city-owned vacant properties back on the tax rolls into productive use. I would love to be able to talk to you about that because I agree. I believe the caller's name is Charlie. I agree with him.
This is Leo.
Leo. That we need to do better. One of the things we are doing, though, he mentioned that we should be using our ex-offender population to do we should be doing more job training, and we are. I stood with a number of ex-offenders, I believe it was in the Station North community, where they were part of a job training program in the new green economy, where they're being taught and trained how in deconstruction, not just demolition, but deconstruction, so that the parts of these old houses that are marketable, the bricks and such, the beams are being able to be marketed. So they are gaining a skill and getting on the job market as we are creating revitalized neighborhoods. And I'd love to talk more about that when I come in and talk about the new restructuring.
Glad to have you back. Looking forward to hearing about this restructuring. When's it going to be announced?
Before the end of September.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to that.
Thank you for your time, Madam Mayor.
Thanks for having me.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, great to have you in the studio once again.
Thanks.
Good luck. Folks, we're going to take a very brief break, like just seconds, come right back with Anthony McCarthy and I to talk with you, so we'll get to your calls. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. Don't go away. Don't hang up. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And I'm still here with Anthony McCarthy, host of the Anthony McCarthy Show, and numerous other things that he's doing. But
blessed. Mark, very interesting this time we got to spend with the mayor. One thing that you asked, and I appreciate the mayor's answer on the Pat Jessamy and Frederick Biofield, our Commissioner Biofield, his support of her opponent in the primary. And she believes they'll be able to move past that, that they're professionals. I have to tell you, there's a great deal of conversation. It's going to get much nastier this race before... Greg Bernstein and our Pat state's Jessamy. Attorney, Pat Jessamy. A lot of questions being raised about race loyalty. A lot of questions being raised. Greg Bernstein announced that he raised over $200,000 in the last fundraising period, which makes him a very serious contender. He will have the money he needs, including the money that he's raised since the deadline, to compete on the air with commercials and obviously the mailings and get out the vote. Patricia Jessamy, I'm sure, I haven't seen her numbers, been able to raise a lot of money.
I'm sure she has.
But Mark, I'm telling you, there is, and you know this because we have many friends in common and a lot of people contact us about this. The racial component of this race for state's attorney is under the surface. And I'm afraid if someone doesn't talk about it in a reasonable and rational manner, that it will get very ugly and a disservice to the voters, disservice to Ms. Jessamy, disservice to Mr. Bernstein. But it's very interesting to watch Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, our mayor, cool as a cucumber. She has grown tremendously in this role as mayor of the city of Baltimore.
Well, I think there is a racial component to this, and we don't like to talk about it. We like to not address it or deal with it. Anytime you have an African-American woman who's state's attorney, who's been attacked by a former mayor who's white, who was very disrespectful to her in the attack, and he's now our governor.
And the words that he used, definitely.
And the words he used. I mean, it raised the hackles of people in the community, in the black community. To say it's not that race doesn't enter it is ridiculous. I mean, of course it does. The question I'm trying to figure out, though, is what's the bottom line here? What is really the difference between what Pat Jessamy would do and what Greg Bernstein would do if he became state's attorney? And I like to see what our listeners think and where they are with all this. I mean, the political question, politically, that Pat Jessamy could be in trouble in an election if black folks come out to vote.
That's right. Not
as
only
could
Pat
Martin
Jessamy.
O'Malley.
That's what I was going to say. And the governor.
As could Martin O'Malley. Mm-hmm. But in a deeper sense, I'm more concerned with what is the real fundamental difference between a Greg Bernstein and Pat Chesimee. Now, Greg Bernstein will be on the show tomorrow night. We wanted him to
and
come
he'll
here.
Be on my show on Friday.
He'll be on your show Friday. Mm-hmm. Good. And we wanted him to come on with
we did.
State's Attorney Chesimee. That couldn't happen tomorrow. She may be on next week. And I know that both you and I are now working with her campaign
That's
and
right.
his campaign to have them both come on before the election to talk
That's
with one another
important.
On the air. Mm-hmm. And to run a respectful conversation inside the studio with the two of us. So I hope they agree to do that, because I think that would be important for our citizens to be able to hear that. And we'll have them on separately, but I'd rather have them on together to discuss the issues to find out what the difference
is. But you just raised such an important point. I know we have some listeners still yeah. holding on who want to join the conversation. Because, Mark, there's so much finger-pointing that goes on. And in this environment, where regardless of the reality, and the mayor articulated the numbers about crime, and she said that Pat Chesimee is her partner in crime reduction, there is a perception. And we know in politics and in life, perceptions often become the rule. There is a perception that people are pointing fingers at the efficiency and effectiveness of Pat Chesimee's state's attorney's office. But the bigger question, and the question we have to check those statistics that Greg Bernstein has become well known for throwing out there about conviction rates and other things, is how different would that be if there's a different strategy? And how much can we expect the state's attorney's office to be able to, given the realities that the mayor spoke of? People don't want to step forward and be
right.
witnesses. People don't want to come in and be on juries. People don't want to take part in what frightens them, trying to run gangs and thugs out of their neighborhoods and communities. So to point the finger at the state's attorney, we have to ask the hard questions. And you are great at asking the hard questions. But we also have to ask, is it easy just to throw stones? Or what would actually be different if Pat Chesimee was removed as the state's attorney? Would we make a big change?
I mean, we're already locking up lots of people in Baltimore City.
Yep.
Lots of people who are arrested for nonviolent crimes, who sit in jails waiting to come
Long
to court.
Long periods of time.
Who have high bails for things like smoking or selling a little bit of marijuana, for urinating in an alley, mm-hmm. for
Open containers. Sitting in jail for a long time.
For having a bag of heroin. Or whatever it is. All those things are against the law.
Of course.
But do we take nonviolent offenders and fill up our jails with them? I'm interested if our state's attorney and the man who would replace her, what would they do about that? I mean, that's as important as how you deal with the thugs. And I think that how we deal with the thugs is a real question. Who charges them? That's still an issue the police and the state's attorney haven't come to grips with. Who does the charging? The state's attorney or the police? State's attorney says, well, the police does the charging. That's why we can't get convictions.
That's right, because of the weak charging by the police department.
So those are the
police
questions.
Department says, look, the state's attorney drops the ball. We give them evidence. We give them solid cases, and they can't prosecute. So, I mean, a lot of finger pointing. It's good. This is a very important election. I think I'm surprised at the attention, but it is a very important election.
It is. September 14th is the primary. Is that right?
Yes.
So people are coming back for vacation. Maybe it'll pick up mm-hmm. post-September 1st. One would think. Mm-hmm. What do our listeners think? At 410-319-8888, unless you're still going to wax forth about the mayor being here, which is fine. Let's go to who's been holding on the longest. We'll go to William and then Trevor. William, you're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, Mr. Steiner and
good evening.
Mr. McCarthy. How are you?
Hi, Trevor.
Yeah. My question was for the mayor. If she was aware that the Department of Defense and also the Department of Energy has a program to give cities solar panels, wind turbines, you know, different things of that nature, and also fuel cells. There's a couple of Swiss schools that got grants from the Department of Energy to get fuel cells to run their whole school system.
Did you say Swiss?
As far as the schools having air conditioning and things like that nature, there's a lot of technology available. It's just a matter of applying to the Department of Energy for it, you know, and also the Department of Defense.
Well, I don't really know about that. I would like to know more about that, and we can have
the
producer looking that up, and we can kind of address that.
But I can tell you that if there are monies available to make our school system as well as our city government more efficient when it comes to energy usage, I am sure that this administration, as the previous and future administrations, always looking for federal grant dollars, always looking for monies that would make their ability to institute these kind of policies easier. So I'm sure that this mayor's administration is looking into all kinds of places they can find dollars.
Let's go to who's been holding on again. Trevor, you're on the air.
Hello, good afternoon, Mark.
Hi, Trevor. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Anthony. Anthony, that's all right.
That's right.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Anthony.
That's all right.
Thanks for taking my call. Listen, I just want to say basically, I've been living in this city for 18 years, for as long as I've been in America. My home was burglarized, and I'm calling, this is more of a personal nature for me. My home was burglarized a year ago. The cop that showed up initially, he took the report and said that the fingerprinting squad would show up. He called them, and they were en route. 2.5 hours later, nobody showed up. When I called them, then they said they were unaware that any report was made. A long story short, this has been going on for 1 year. Every time I call, there's nobody to give an account. Nobody can tell me anything. I had a captain who got in, it seems that he was upset, and said that he personally will call me. Never called me since. It's been 1 year. I can understand why people are moving out of this city. It's not just the crime. It's so many things. I used to love Baltimore City when I first came here initially. But the schools, they leave a bitter taste in my mouth. The crime is ridiculous. Police force, I'm not sure if they have a handle on, you can see they don't have a handle on what's going on in this city. It's really, the interest rates, it's just too much. And I can understand why people just want to move out. It's ridiculous.
Trevor, we will have on. Actually, you can probably ask that question of the commissioner, who I hope will be on. Let me check my calendar. Next week, we're hoping he's going to be here as part of this program. And let me take a quick look, see if it's booked. I don't know if it's booked yet or not. Yes, it is. It is booked. Can I speak this safely? I think he's on 5 to 6 p.m. on August the 26th, which is next Thursday evening. So please feel free to call back and talk about your case then, when the commissioner is on the air.
Thanks, Trevor.
Yes. And we are doing a little announcement here that's really interesting before we go to the top of the hour, which is that Governor
Blagojevich.
Blagojevich, thank you, Blagojevich, was convicted only of one count.
Wow.
One count of lying to the FBI, and was a hung jury on the 23 other counts.
And he was removed from office.
And he was removed from office.
Mm.
Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting.
So I thought I'd just share that. It just came off across the wire, and if you didn't know it, you know it now. And
to jump back into politics.
Oh, you know he will with this, because
he's going to say he's been pretty much vindicated.
Right.
You know, interesting.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So, folks, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to address the issue of mosques in our communities. And it's a very serious issue, not just in New York City, where it's been talked about, but in communities across this country.
Including right here in Maryland. Frederick, Maryland. A very serious.
Where people oppose the construction of mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is why? We're going to talk to several Muslim leaders about that, and talk about the complexity of the Islamic world, talk about what's going on in America with that. And we have chosen not to have ranting anti-Islamists on the air for this conversation, but to have a conversation where we can talk to the Islamic community and kind of get to some issues. And we want you to join us here for that. So stay with us, and we'll be right back to have the conversation after this brief break.